Hello, hello. You are listening to the next episode of The Break Breakdown. I'm Courtney, and today's episode is actually going to be a little bit different. So it's a solo episode, and this is a podcast about making a film, about making my film Screen Test, an indie short film, and all the kind of backstory of how it came to be. But today, I actually wanted to talk about something that it just keeps coming up for me in every facet of my life. And I feel like in the times that we're in, it's important to talk about. So today I want to talk about my journey with anxiety and how it's influenced my approach and my kind of philosophies around creating work. So I never named my anxiety until I had a panic attack riding the subway during one of my first days back at work postpartum after having Elle. So Elle was about 4 months old. I, for whatever reason, when I left that morning, she was crying. She didn't want me to go. And I was walking to the subway. I got on the subway, and I had done this before. It wasn't the first time I had left her to go to work. And by the way, she was with Craig. Like, she was with her dad. Everything was fine. It wasn't even like I had to have the whole drop off at daycare ritual, and she's with people I don't know. Like, she's at home, she's with her dad, everything is cool. Mom's just gonna go to work. And literally, I think I was going for 4 hours. But I get on the subway and I start freaking out. Like, I am emotionally just at an extreme all of a sudden, almost out of nowhere, where my rational brain knew she's crying, but she's okay. Like, she's just like, she doesn't want the change, or like maybe she was hungry, or like, you know, all these rational reasons why a 4-month-old might be crying. But I'm sitting on the subway and I just start losing it. Like, I start sweating. I have tears in my eyes, like trying to hold them back and not cry. I am looking all around me. I'm clocking everyone because I just think I'm going to die on this subway and I'm never going to know my child and she's never going to know me. And like, actually, even just now thinking about it, like, I'm getting really choked up even just like thinking about that moment. I saw posters on the subway that were like, you know, playing into themes of death for whatever reason. And it just was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, spin, spin, spin. Okay. So I get off the subway and I'm fine, but I'm physically fine. I'm mentally like a mess. And I just kept thinking like, oh my God, does Craig know all the passwords to all the accounts? Like, like really going there, right? And it was really disorienting for me because I had never had something that, I don't know, I guess obvious. It was so obviously not how I usually ride the subway. I don't usually have panic attacks on the subway. I've lived in New York for, what year is it? I've lived here for 13 years. Like, the subway doesn't bother me. And I, you know, was dealing with, at the time, Elle was 4 months old, and I was dealing still with postpartum anxiety. People talk about postpartum depression a lot, but there's another thing called postpartum anxiety. And of course, anxiety and depression kind of go hand in hand and work together in lots of really fun ways. I was really on the anxiety kick. And, you know, I had a really difficult labor with Elle, and that's another podcast for another time, but it went in all sorts of different ways. Finally, she came and everything was healthy and we were really lucky and we had great care, thank God, because a lot of women a lot of Black women don't have great health care and maternity care, but we did, thank God. And so but Craig and I were both really still processing the labor after it happened, and we were home and everything was fine. And one of the ways that I processed that whole experience of giving birth was actually through writing poetry. And I hadn't planned on it, and it wasn't something that was like, you know, something I was thinking about or something that I was planning to do. But I ended up, you know, being stuck in a chair, breastfeeding a lot, and not really being able to move or do anything, and not really being able to be on my computer to do any long form writing. So I started just typing up little things on my phone and scrolling through pictures of my daughter and just being basically obsessed with her. And I ended up writing all this poetry about my experience, you know, before, during, and after my labor and Elle's birth. And, you know, it was this really beautiful time. And I had I had 3 months off, right, for maternity leave with, you know, I couldn't do anything except stay in the present moment. You know, there's lots of boredom during that time. There's lots of exhaustion. And I think boredom and exhaustion kind of give you a great fertile ground to stand on to make something like that. So I got through that period, and that was really helpful. But as I went back into the real world and kind of came out of my little cocoon of postpartum maternity leave, I wrote a little bit less, you know, I made a little bit less because I was getting back to work again and all of that, and all of the daily, you know, responsibilities that had to get done. And I had this little panic attack, and I just kind of wrote it off as like, oh, well, you're getting back to work. It's normal. It's natural. Every mom goes through this. And while I do think anxiety is quite normal and, quite prolific, at least in all the folks that I love and adore, it's not easy, and it's not something that deserves to be ignored. But ignore it I did. And so just this past year, I don't know if you know this, but 2020 has been an absolute horror in so many ways. And, you know, it's, I think, a year that's bringing a lot of things to the surface that are tricky on a collective level and tricky on an individual level. And for me, that anxiety that I had thought had kind of gone away after I got through that transition period back to going back to work after having Elle, that anxiety has gone nowhere. In fact, it's like set up shop. It's broken ground a few places. I mean, there's a whole village of anxiety living inside of me that moved in while I was busy like pumping breast milk. So this past year, actually like not all that long ago from the recording of this podcast, Craig says to me very carefully and very lovingly, like, okay, your anxiety, I think it's beyond just your labor and the anxiety and the trauma around that. I think like this is something you've actually been living with your whole life and you haven't ever named. And, you know, I don't know why it never occurred to me that that was the case, but he said it and I was like, oh my God, he's totally right. Like, I've been feeling like this is just a natural way to live. And I don't, and, you know, not that anxiety is a choice, but like there's actually another option out there. And if I can get to it, that would actually make me happier and make me, you know, probably more productive. Because I was living in this, and I have been, and I still am to a degree, living in a really hyper anxious state. You know, like as a kid, I don't know why, but I was like always scared of getting a detention. Like, and I got in trouble. It's not like I didn't do bad things as a kid. Like, I broke rules and stuff as a kid, but I don't know why. I was just, like, really scared that if I ever got a detention, it'd be, like, the worst thing to ever happen to me. Okay. I went through a period when I was in middle school that I was just, like, really scared that my, like, someone I love would just, like, die in a car crash. It was just, that was, like, a big thing for me. And those are like kind of like childhood things that I can pick up on. But, you know, as an adult, my anxiety comes out through my work ethic because I will get super intense in my work ethic, which, you know, you would say, this sounds like I'm like in a job interview and someone's like, what's your weakness? And I'm like, oh, I just care so much. I'm not saying it like that. I'm saying this as in like my work ethic actually ruins other parts of my life. Like, I'm not proud of it. It's beyond what anyone expects. It's like, I get super intense and it's just a control mechanism for me. It's to be like, okay, I know if I can put so much effort in and so much, you know, like go above and beyond every single time, then that means that everything's going to be okay. Like, it's not a noble place to live in my mind. But so you see, like, even me just describing that, all of a sudden I feel like my blood pressure is going up. but I guess I wanted to put this out there, and by the way, I should say, like, nothing that I'm saying in this is in this episode is, I mean, I'm not giving advice on anxiety, on how to deal with it. I'm not giving advice on depression or any kind of mental health stuff. This is not advice. I just want to share my story with you because I think that it could be, I don't know, I hope that it would be helpful for others to hear. And I kind of want to put it in context of, I mean, I don't kind of, I actually do really want to put it in context of Screen Test, because Screen Test came out last week. And whenever you release some work like that, that's, you know, a long time coming, I think a lot of people make believe in their heads that everything's super easy for you. You're just like whipping out work left and right. And like this whole kind of romanticizing happens. At least that's what I think when I see other people's work come to fruition in the world. I'm really happy for them, and I completely romanticize that, like, of course they did that because they're wonderful. And I'm not saying you're sitting there thinking like I'm wonderful for putting out Screen Tests, but just in case there's any rosy picture, I just actually want you to have the real picture. And you know, not to quote myself, but because I want it to be authentic. Okay, so I'm telling you my background with anxiety too, because this is on an individual level. I'm feeling all these things. And this has gone on through my entire life. And when it comes to making art and releasing our work and doing things like this, there are the internal forces and external forces that I think work against us. Okay, so the internal force for me is anxiety, all right? That's my baseline. I'm working on it. We'll see how I feel when I release this episode, how anxious that day is. but whatever. But I wanted to say that too, because this anxiety and this, you know, quote unquote vulnerability that I have with it, and vulnerability by not addressing it. The anxiety itself is not a vulnerability, but my lack of addressing it in the past has been. I think that makes sense. I hope that makes sense. But because of that vulnerability, it made me the perfect candidate to be sucked into a few different communities that could then play on all of my anxieties that I had not been dealing with. So there were a few jobs that I held in my work life long ago that, you know, preyed on those vulnerabilities. But the main one was a multi-level marketing scheme, also known as a pyramid scheme. So, okay, I'm not going to name what I did because, honestly, these people's lawyers are crazy and I just don't know what's okay to say or not. Like, literally years and years later, this was a long time ago, but years later, I still don't know what is, like, legally possible for me to say. So, if you don't know what an MLM is, I'll give you the brief breakdown. You buy into, like, there's a company and they sell something and you want to buy that something. And someone says, okay, you can either buy it or you can get a discount by signing up to be on my team. And then you get other people to join and yada, yada, yada. That's how the pyramid is formed. Now, I'm saying this knowing that there are probably people who listen to this who are participating in an MLM. And this is in no way a judgment of you at all whatsoever. I literally am just telling my story with one specific company at one specific time with one specific group of people. So I'm really not making a judgment whatsoever. But I think it's really important to talk about this particular experience in in the context of making art, because it literally, I was coached, and I mean coached on telephone calls, in meetings, in emails, in every sense of the way, I was coached to believe that the only way I could be an artist was if I, for the long term, in my entire life, was if I joined this MLM, this company. Okay, so when I say it like that, it sounds crazy. However, when you are experiencing a heightened level of anxiety, like I was when I met the group of people who kind of brought me into the MLM, you are already in a state where you're disconnected from your intuition and your gut. And I've been thinking a lot about how, you know, my anxiety is really, really loud, but I'm trying to get my intuition to speak louder. And when is my anxiety speaking and when is my intuition speaking? And at that point in my life, when I joined the MLM, I had just gotten married. My husband was in Alabama at Alabama Shakespeare Festival being an actor. I was working a day job at a bar where I was being sexually harassed by my boss and the customers. And I had been auditioning and trying to get a job, and I was in the middle of a 3-year drought of not working on stage, of auditioning all the time, getting super close to stuff, and not getting the gig. Okay, so very vulnerable, very anxious human being, alone because I was in New York and Craig was in Alabama. Oh my God, it was like, mwah, chef's kiss, perfect time for someone to be like, hey, join this group. Okay, so what, have you guys watched The Vow? Okay, so just a little tangent. So Craig and I are watching The Vow, and every time something happens in it, he's like, how did they not see it? How do they not know? Every time we watch anything about a cult, I'll be like, dude, I'm telling you, this is how it works. Like, okay, first of all, you know, the sunk cost, you know, you've already spent X amount of dollars. So like, you're trying to make it work because you're like, oh, that's a sunk cost. I can't, if I leave now, I lose however much money I invested. They like keep the leader away from you for a while of this whole, you know, company. It's not, I can't even call it a company, just like this whole group. Keep the leader away from you for a while and tell you how amazing she is and how just smart she is and how funny and how just like alive and rich and like all these things. And then you meet her and you're like, wait, I don't get it, but I guess I'm wrong because everyone else sees it. Like, and they play on this disconnect that you have to your intuition. They play on the anxious side of your brain. And they'll say, like, that's just your, I mean, they won't say that's your anxiety, right? But that's your self-doubt, sweetheart. Like, you're a rock star, you know? Like, that's your mind making up things, trying to self-sabotage because you don't believe that you should be successful, but you should believe in your success. So then, like, they're not, what they're saying isn't wrong. Like, you should believe in yourself, but they're putting it all in the context of this leader and this organization and this specific path that you follow to then achieve your dreams. So this is what was pitched to me. You can be on Broadway, but first you have to succeed in this organization. And that's the only way it's ever going to work. Okay. And by the way, I looked up a list of what is it called? High demand group or movement, quote unquote cult. Like, what are these characteristics? And I'm just going to read a couple of them to you because I find it fascinating, and I also feel a little bit like in America, where we have a capitalist society, capitalism is based off of competition and kind of like dog eat dog mentality at its lowest, at its darkest, you know? So I think we're really primed as an American people to filter into these groups. Okay, so this is what this list that I found on the internet, you know, so take it for what it's worth, but this is what they say the characteristics, just some of them, of a cult. The group is focused on a living leader to whom members seem to display excessively zealous, unquestioning commitment. Check, that was my experience. The group is preoccupied with bringing in new members. Yes, check, because the way I brought in new members, or the way the organization brought in new members, was like really the only way you could actually make real money. The other ways of selling the products, like, I don't know anyone who like actually made a lot of money doing that. The group is preoccupied with making money. Check. Yep, we did ribbon ceremonies for how much money you made that week. It was, the whole thing was about making money. Questioning, doubt, and dissent are discouraged or even punished. Yes, I brought up a couple things in the beginning of my time there and was told, like, you know what, this is not how we do things. And my own like anxious mind was like, oh, like Courtney, this is just, you're just like messing this up. Like you can never, you know, do anything right, blah, blah, blah. Okay, great. Mind numbing techniques, such as meditation, chanting, speaking in tongues, denunciation sessions, debilitating work routines are used to suppress doubts about the group and its leader. Yes, just like call and response stuff is weird. The leadership dictates sometimes in great detail how members should think, act, and feel. Yep, like to the point of like what clothes we should wear. The group is elitist, claiming a special exalted status for itself, its leaders, and members. Yes, the group has a polarized, this is what I can't stand. The group has a polarized us versus them mentality, which causes conflict with the wider society. They would always, I shouldn't say always, many times, I heard many times about people in the organization putting down husbands and being like, well, she doesn't have a supportive husband. And I was like, wait a minute, this is weird. Why is like everyone's husband sucks? Like, I mean, I know marriage is really hard. Like, I'm not saying like, you know, Craig doesn't suck or I don't suck sometimes, but like everyone at all times, everyone's husband is awful. That's weird. The leadership induces guilt feelings in members in order to control them. Anyway, there's more. I don't need to like say all of it, but I'm just trying to say that not to be like provocative about this organization that I was a part of, but because it preyed on me at a time when I was super vulnerable and unclear in my intuition. And they found something in me that I really wanted, which at that time was to be on Broadway or at least to be a working actor. And they molded my kind of initiation around that goal in service of, we're going to help you reach that goal. And look, I don't know that, you know, this is the difficult thing with these places. Like everyone that's in it is to a certain extent is a victim of it, right? So it's complicated. You know, they told me that Craig was trying to hold me back. And Craig and I had this huge conversation one day. I had done a retreat with them and I came home and he was like, look, I've been looking stuff up on the internet. Like, how much money have we sunk into this so far? / you got to get out. And he said, Courtney, you know, they tell you you can be anything and can do anything. And I'm telling you, you can do anything. You don't have to do this. And it was this light bulb moment that I have where I was like, oh my God, my husband is sitting here telling me, like, I can get out of this and I can go on to be whoever I want and be whatever I want. And I know that if I brought that back to them and I said that, they would say, well, he's trying to hold you back. And I have this moment, this is all happening in a split second. I had this moment of thinking like, are you going to side with these people that you barely know or your husband who loves you more than anyone. And I was like, oh, crap. I'm in a cult. And like, thank God for Craig. So anyway, there's so much more to say about that. And you know, I have so much writing in me about that. And like, ooh, therapy's going to get juicy because I'm still processing it. But what was so crazy was that I had to have a breakup with them on the phone. And like, I won't tell you how awful and how, I won't go into the details of how awful it was and how manipulative it was and how, like, we don't have time for that. But I will just say the person who was in charge of the organization was very, Christian and would talk about God a lot and all that. And she just like wouldn't take no for an answer. And like, I didn't have the wherewithal or the, I don't know, strength to just hang up on them. And so finally, to stop the conversation, I was like, well, you know what? I prayed about it last night and Jesus told me to quit. I had to tell her. I was like, dude, I gotta go. I gotta like restart my life again. And you know, I'm laughing about it now, but I'm telling you guys, I was so ashamed of myself. I was so ashamed. And the next couple of places that I landed as far as work goes, I would never speak about it. I would never tell people. It was such a huge part of my life for a very short, intense period of about 8 months. And I had many ups and downs within it. And it was like super defining. And I would not talk about it. And in fact, the therapist that I was seeing the year after I was in that, I never brought it up with her, which is really telling. So anyway, so now I still gotta work on it. But it was really shameful. I called everyone that I was working with who I had brought in to the organization, and I told them as much as I could, but I was also scared. They like scared me with retaliation about stuff and like said, like, you're telling people this or you're telling people that, or like, we're going to come after you with lawyer. Like, they were really threatening and weird. And so whatever. Okay. So why did I tell you that story when we're talking about Screen Test, the short film that I released last week? So we're not making art in a vacuum. Okay. That's a really like, I don't know, I think colorful story to illustrate how we kind of come into the creative world with anxiety or depression or like whatever it is, right? Whatever that like inner world is. And that then we also have the external forces working. So we have the internal and we have the external. You know, we're dealing with the nature part of it and the nurture part. We are being hunted by our own demons, but then there are forces outside of us coming to our weak spots. And you know, I'm an optimistic person, so I promise that I will get to a lighter place with this. But I do think that especially right now, when the world is so anxious, when we are isolated because of coronavirus, when we are disconnected from our friends and family, from our routines, from, you know, even just the things that I miss are, I used to go work at this coffee shop down the block, and you know, one day I got into this conversation with this dude who like started telling me about his, you know, Native American ancestry and his daughter marrying into the Jewish faith to a man living in Israel, and their and his first granddaughter, and like the cross-cultural thing, like those meetings with strangers that you just don't have. That's I think that's what one of the things I miss the most, just the ability to like connect on these random, seemingly meaningless but very meaningful moments with others. You know, it's hard. It is hard. And we are so broken and hurt, and we are all looking for a way forward. And man, it's hard to see it. It's hard. I just had to turn off the news this week. I just couldn't do it. And you know, when I released Screen Test, the good thing about making Screen Test was we filmed on one day, a 12-hour day in February. And it was like right up to the deadline, right before everything shut down, like a couple weeks before it shut down. So we were already in post. Hard drives were where they needed to be. We had the meetings we needed to have. And then everything shut down. So when you're in post-production, you know, you're really just working on the computer. I couldn't, you know, be in the editing room with the editor, with our editor, Marga. But, that's not how we had planned on working anyway. But I'm just throwing that out there to say sometimes directors and editors work in the same room together, cutting the film. But we were always going to work on our computer. So really, coronavirus did not impact our production at all, except for my mental state. And it was really hard for me to, I just took so long with the editing on my end because all of my anxieties just kept flaring up. My normal go-tos of feeling grounded and feeling like myself, which are usually like seeing my friends, going out to dinner, you know, taking Elle out in the world and just meeting strangers and like playing and, you know, bring her to a museum or to the park or whatever, just like being a part of the world. Like the whole reason that you live in New York City is not for your apartment, it's for New York effing city, you know? And we couldn't have that. And those were my outlets. Those are still my outlets. And it's hard. So I could not, it took me like a month to get back to Marga with edits just because I couldn't concentrate and I couldn't focus and I couldn't zoom out 30,000 feet to be like, okay, what does this need? What is the story? What is in service of the story and what is taking away, you know, all those details. It was really hard to do. So I'm saying this because if you have found it hard to make work during quarantine or to be creative or kind of find any flow that makes you feel good, like, of course, like, dude, yes, because it's hard. Like if you've done nothing but survive, then great, because surviving is a big job. And it takes a lot of willpower some days, you know? And so when you see people making work like, or releasing work like Screen Test, this does not mean that the anxiety is not there. It doesn't mean that it is a flawless process. It doesn't mean that it's without its, you know, warts, so to speak. And I remember reading a letter, what's it called? Letters to a Young Artist. Yeah, Letters to a Young Artist by Anna Deavere Smith. I read it right out of college. And I remember reading the quote that she said, and I didn't totally get it then, but I was like, but it stuck with me as like, oh, this is something you're going to understand as you get older. She said, when you feel isolated, reach out from your isolation. And I think what she meant by that was, you know, don't deny how you feel, but till the ground of your feelings, you know, let it be the earth on which you root down to grow up and to reach out. And if you've ever felt isolated or cut off or anxious or scared or depressed or fearful or sad or any of these things that generally make us feel alone, it's actually from that ground that we can find our way through it. You know, so many years I spent not honoring my own anxieties and my own mental health struggles because I don't know why. You know, I don't know why. And that's like, you know, I'll deal with that in therapy, not here. But if we don't till that ground, if we don't acknowledge it, then we're kind of cutting off one of our paths through it. You know, and I'm not saying it's the only way, and I'm not saying it's not a multifaceted way. And again, I'm not giving you any advice. Please do not take any advice from me. I don't know anything. I'm literally just sharing my own story with you. But I have found that the only way for me to find my way out of like my own personal darkness is to speak it and own it. So, you know, it's funny. So a friend asked me if I was excited about releasing screen tests like a couple days before. And we released screen tests last week, which was like the first or second week of October 2020. So if you're listening to this in the future, I don't know what happens in the future. We haven't had an election yet, but we had a president who didn't denounce white supremacy and then got coronavirus. So like, that's all we know right now. So future you, if you're listening, I hope you're having a laugh because it all worked out. But right now, if you're listening to this when the episode releases, we do not know how it's going to turn out. So anyway, that was the week that screen test released, and my friend asked me if I was excited, and I was like, actually, I'm completely numb about it because I'm so overcome with what's going on in the world and my own inner struggles that I, I wasn't actually excited until it was actually happening, and then I could actually sink into the moment and experience it. And by the way, for everyone who came to the premiere, thank you so much. That was so much fun to watch it and chat with you guys before and after. I was so grateful that you were there. It really lifted me up in the middle of what was obviously a dark week. And thank you for that. But again, just want to say that when we're making art like this, and by the way, when I say art, I'm just saying it with a small a. This is not like highbrow art. I'm not on a, you know, in an ivory tower or anything. Like, this is just like, make a little bit of art. You know what I mean? So anyway, I just don't want, when I say art, I'm saying it in an accessible way. And, you know, when we make it, we're not in a vacuum. And, you know, weeks like this and times like this that we're living in make me think, you know, why do we make art? Why do we even do it? And you know, that I think the reason is, and I'm going to lay it out for you, but of why, but I think the reason that we make art is, well, I don't know if it's the reason, but I think that art reminds us how to be a human. And then when we remember how to be a human, then it gives us the chance to really, truly be here right now. And truly, really, truly being here right now in this exact moment, not the one before or the one that's coming next, I think is quite magical because anything can happen. And I don't know. I've been raising a child now for almost 2 years, and all they do is live in the present moment, and their world is like a magical wonderland of hope and wishes and imagination. And, you know, I could go off on a tangent about motherhood, but I won't. Again, another podcast for another time. But, you know, I'm thinking about this as an adult too, right? So I was really getting into a bad mental state last night. I was feeling just really down yesterday, and then I was listening to the news, and I was like, no. I don't have the capacity to show up for this in the thoughtful, resilient way that I want to show up for this information. And this information is too important. This news is too important for me to not show up to it fully. So I'm going to take some time, and I'm going to fill myself back up so I can meet it the way it needs to be met. So within that time, I started watching music videos of St. Lennox. Now, if you've seen Screen Test, you know that St. Lennox is the musician behind the closing credit song, which I feel like is almost like the epilogue of the piece. He's this amazing human being who I reached out to and told him how his music really helped me through my first postpartum days, and would it be okay to use a song? And he said yes. And I mean, it's just the most generous thing, and I just think it's amazing. And it just, it honestly makes the movie, the film, mean so much more to me, because he allowed us to use that song. But I watch his music videos last night because they are just so cool. Like, I think I talked about them before on another episode, but they're essentially like these, like, I don't want to say gritty, but just, I don't even know what the word is. They're just so cool. I'm like, literally, I don't know what to say. But he has this beautiful music that he creates, and then he creates these images, and then he also has text that's captioned in that has nothing to do with the song itself. It's not like the lyrics or anything, and it's not what's happening in the movie or in the, you know, visual. So you have like three points of information coming at you as an audience member: the music, the visual, and the words. And it is so exciting to watch. And I think some of it he's filmed on his iPhone, and that's why I'm saying gritty, because it's not like a, you know, it's not like studio produced or something like that. It's just so cool, and it makes me feel less alone, because the things that he's talking about are like, they're just the things that we need to be talking about, you know. For me, like, that's where I connect, and I connect with his melody and his music, and his voice is incredible. And the point that I'm making is just that, like, art has that capacity to make you feel less alone. It has that capacity to make you feel somewhat whole, even for like 3 minutes and 40 seconds of a song. You're like, I get it. You get it. There are other people like me who get it. We're doing this. I'm not alone out there. Not all is lost. Not all is futile. And I don't know how I found this Stanley Kubrick quote. But he said, so Stanley Kubrick said, if you really want to communicate something, even if it's just an emotion or an attitude, let alone an idea, the least effective and least enjoyable way is directly. It only goes in about an inch. But if you can get people to the point where they have to think a moment what it is you're getting at and then discover it, the thrill of discovery goes right through the heart. So what Kubrick's talking about is poetry, right? Not just like written poetry, just like the idea of something being poetic. And, you know, we can watch politicians or talking heads or whoever say, like, this is what's right and this is what's wrong. But when an artist poses a question and lets us live in that experience without directly saying what it is they think, you know, maybe they have a really big point of view, or maybe they're just asking a question, but they're letting us live in that thrill of discovery. I think this is what it means to be human sometimes. You know, like, I don't know if art matters in times like these. Like, sometimes I'm like, no, I need to be a politician, or like, I need to be a speechwriter, or like, I need to do something like specific and policy-wise to help the world and help my community and help the world that I'm giving to my daughter. But then I think about what art does for me personally in my life, you know, and there's a balance between policy and culture and creating culture, because you create the culture and then you can push for the policy. And it's an ebb and a flow, right? And if a policy is created, it will create a culture. So if that policy is made and that culture is created and it is inhumane and it is wrong, then it's up to you as a taste maker, as a culture maker, as an artist, to right that wrong, right? And if you can't do it through policy, then you have to do it through culture, which is art. And I think about, you know, like, good artists for me are, who do this for me personally, are St. Lennox, Run the Jewels, Toby Wigway, Mary Oliver, Nina Simone, Toni Morrison, Joni Mitchell. Like, these are people who have contributed to the culture, contributed to our understanding of ourselves, and help us express in ways that cut through our collective and individual pain. you know, and they are the people for me, you know, for everyone it's different. It's like whoever's going to speak to you, these are the artists who've spoken to me. But these are the people who are going to create the culture in which we can create a better world from, right? Or we can imagine a better world. You know, and for me, for Screen Test, I'm not saying that it has done that. You know, I'm not saying the art that I've made or will make ever will create a culture or a better world. And honestly, it's not my business if it does or if it doesn't. It's none of my business. Once I'm done with it, once I've done making it and I've said what I had to say, the only business I have tinkering with it is learning from it so I can improve on whatever I want to improve on the next time. Other than that, how it impacts the world is like 0% my responsibility, or my business is really a better way to put it. But I do know, you know, I do know that other people's art has helped me. It has helped, it has literally helped me feel better, feel stronger, feel more able to make an impact in my small world. You cannot listen to Run the Jewels 4 without wanting to make an impact in your small world. You just can't. you really can't. And if we lost that, if we lost that kind of art, what would we be left with? Like, what does a world without art look like? You know, we act like art is icing on top, but it's not the icing, it's the egg. The stupidest metaphor I could come up with, but I think you get it. It's like it holds the whole thing together. You know, it's not extra, it's essential. And if we don't have it, if we don't have the art, then we can't connect. We can't know who we are. You know, Rilke says, live in the questions. We can't live in the questions. This is, okay, so I pulled this quote because this is one of my favorite quotes of all time. If you're going through anything in your life where you're like, WTF, which I'm pretty sure is 98% of Americans today in October of 2020. Here's Rilke's quote for you and for me. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. Is like one of my favorite quotes of all time because it gets you off the hook without getting you off the hook. You know what I mean? It's like, look, you got work to do, but it's not the work you think. It's not crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's. It's something else. And I think art is that thing that allows us to do the something else. You know what I mean? My friend Benji, one of my dearest friends, I love him so much. When I told him that I was pregnant, he told me that being pregnant was the most earnest thing I could do. And you know what? He's not wrong. Like that was, I like that, it like still tickles me, obviously. I think it's so funny. But I think it's so funny because it's true. You know, the idea that like we can give life to something, to, you know, to someone brand new that has never existed in all the history of being, this human being has never existed, and we can kind of be the conduit for that person to become. It's like, that's crazy, man. That's crazy. And I think you can relate that to making art and making your art. And you know, there are lots of things in this world that want to stop us from making art, you know? Like when I was doing that culty thing in that culty organization, which shall not be named, they kept promising me that if I just committed a little more, if I just took on a little bit more, if I just focused on this a little bit more, then I could be an artist. you know, they didn't say it like that, right? They'd say things like, Courtney, what is it that you want? What is it that you want? Why can't you have that? You know, you can have that when you have this financial freedom, when you don't have to work for a boss who's sexually harassing you every other day, when you don't have to, you know, worry about making rent. Like, you can have that. And then the crazy part with that too was, I remember, just as I was telling you that, I was remembering what she said later to me, later on. This woman said to me, I was trying to get out of a call with her and I was rehearsing for a show. I had finally booked a show, which, by the way, this organization took credit for. See, you finally booked a show because you're finally on the path that would help you. No, I booked a show because I booked the show. But okay, I didn't say that at the time. I was like, yes, yes, okay, great. And then I was trying to get out of a call with her, okay, intuition was speaking up, right? And I said, you know, I had a really tough day at rehearsal. I like think I pulled a little something and I gotta ice and just rest. And I, you know, can't be on this call. And she said to me, I forget what age I was turning. I had a birthday coming up. And she's like, Courtney, how old are you? Let's just say for like... story, let's just say I was 27 or something like that. How old are you turning? And she goes, and I tell her, and she goes, well, you know what, if you're already getting injured now, like your career, how long do you think you're going to be able to dance? And I was like, oh, I see. You're going to take my innermost anxiety, my innermost fear of not being able to perform anymore because my body's breaking down. And you're going to relate it to this exact moment where I literally like pulled my hamstring or something because I kicked my face like a badass. And you're going to take this moment and you're going to manipulate me to be what you want. And that was like kind of the beginning of the cracks for me to like actually be able to extract myself. But I guess that's coming up for me right now to tell you that because we are constantly coming up against those people. And she was a very, how do I want to say this? Like, that's a really pointed story where you can really point at her and be like, she said that, but there are things, like, she said that to make you feel a certain way, but there are things that are coming up against us like that all the time, asking us to not make the art, right? And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, my feelings of anxiety, like, they are what they are. You know, if you are feeling anxious, you feel what you feel. If you're depressed, you know, what you're going through must be so painful right now. These are not easy times. You know, the road is not an easy road. And I don't know what the right answer is, and I'm not giving any advice. What I have found is, for me, is the best thing that I can ever do is just be gentle with myself, to be kind and to speak to myself like I am my own dearest, oldest friend who needs a lot of love and a lot of tenderness and care. And sometimes as an artist, that means not making the thing yet, you know? And, you know, I'm always a proponent for go out and do it and fail. But I'm also a proponent for listening to what you need to do in order to heal and to grow. Because from that fertile ground is where we're going to make the art that has the power to connect us. Do you know, I didn't plan on talking about this, but you guys know about aspen trees? Aspen trees are these roots, like it's like the biggest body of, I should have looked this up beforehand, but I didn't think of it. Okay, so it's like the biggest, I don't want to say living organism, but I think like maybe that's what people have said. It's just like this huge mass of aspen trees in the west part of the United States. And above the ground, it looks like a whole bunch of individual trees next to each other. But underground, there's this huge root system that connects them. And if one aspen tree is doing poorly, like didn't get enough rain or sun or nutrients or whatever, the mother tree, like there are these mother trees, and the mother tree will send nutrients through the root system, through the network, to the tree that needs a little life. And so, like, I totally heard that once. I have not researched this. Maybe I'm totally full of shit, but it's a beautiful metaphor. And I think it is true, because of the person I heard it from. I do think it's true. But the idea that we are these trees, right? And we're popping up. We're like, here's my work, and here's my new job, and here's my gig, and here's my, you know, film, whatever. But underneath all of that work is actually us reinforcing each other, you know, sending a little life to each other, connecting each other, being in it together, you know, understanding, acknowledging, you know, where there's a gap or a system failing, you know, or someone in need, and sending out like a little signal, a little nutrient, a little boost their way, you know. I don't know, maybe that like really took me on a weird tangent, but I think it makes sense. You know, so like, I'm not a proponent of just like make, you know, do. Like, no, sometimes we need to breathe and we need to, you know, take in someone else's work, you know, listen to St. Lennox, listen to Run the Jewels, look at, you know, Vivian Meyer photography, look at Basquiat, like look at different artists and just allow yourself to live in the question. What am I supposed to make? What am I called to make? What is interesting to me? Or just like, how am I doing? You know, at a basic level, am I taking care of? Am I being gentle with myself? And when you're ready to come back, you know, come back to your work, come back to your art. We don't have to be perfect. You know, we don't even have to be good at making art. The healing is in the effort itself, I have found. You know, the effort to try and understand and connect and live with more integrity, even if we fall short, that can be healing. And, you know, I do want to say making art is a heroic act every time you do it. And I don't think I'm just saying that to pat myself on the back, because I don't feel like a hero, you know, for my film. I don't know. I feel a little bit ambivalent about it. Like, I love that it's out there. I love that people are enjoying it, and I'm like, all right, what's next? Like, it's not, I'm not lingering on it, you know what I mean? But I do think in general, making art is a heroic act every time you do it. Because, like, look, we are facing rejection. We're facing the condescension that sometimes comes towards artists as, like, we're somehow irresponsible or unintelligent. You know, we're facing the fact that the priority in our culture is always being placed on money. And we live in a culture that doesn't really value art until it can be commodified. And once it's commodified, it oftentimes loses its power and impact. You know, we are trying to make art in a system that will try to cut us down with every trick in the book, but doing it anyway, making the art anyway, creating the connections, sending out the little signals to each other that we're here right now, that is resistance. That is an act of resistance. It is resilience. And it is developing and, I think, holding on to a profound integrity, which is, oh God, something I really yearn for in my life. I don't know if you feel that same way. I just want to feel the integrity of something, you know? And so if that's our art, that's our art. So anyway, I have anxiety. And, you know, it's not really gonna go anywhere right now. My goal for therapy is actually that it just gets me a little bit more creative with how I manage it. Like, that's my best case scenario. Like, if I can get really creative with my anxiety and that whole anxiety village that's living inside me, then if I can be creative there, maybe I can make better art. And at the very least, I'll just make more art, you know, get a little bit closer to that inner and outer integrity. I like talked for way too long on this. How much time is this? Oh dear. Okay, that was just me talking for an hour. If you've made it this far, guess what? You win the prize of a really great Joni Mitchell quote. So I save this one for the end. So if you're here, this one is for you. And before I share that with you, I just want to say thank you for listening to this, and thank you for being so kind with the Break Breakdown and with Screen Test. I'm so happy it's out in the world. Please share it if you like it, and let's make those connections with each other the best we can. All right, here's Joni Mitchell. She sums it up. She says, "Keep a good heart. That's the most important thing in life. It's not how much money you make or what you can acquire. The art of it is to keep a good heart." Whew. All right, y'all. Keep a good heart. We got this.